Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
So, then why don't you tell me a little bit about the year apart, and you mentioned that that was an important time for you sort of to prepare yourself for what was coming in your life together, but you knew it was coming, you knew you were going to be getting together at the end of that year, and were really planning on making it permanent. So, was there anything else that makes that year striking or important to talk about?
I think for me, it was a year to really find myself completely and to open up those parts of myself that I had shoved down for 39 years and to really start to establish myself as a whole being in a way I never had. And right before Tanya left, we kind of chanced upon a church in town that had rainbow flags outside, and so we walked inside to see. obviously, we figured they were open and affirming, and so we kind of just walked inside. I think Tanya was giving some books away, was going to sell some books back, and so I walked in while she was doing that down the street and was greeted by two women there, and I had no idea that one of them was a lesbian in a very long-term committed relationship. This had been maybe 40 years at this time that she'd been with this woman. I had no idea because she didn't look the stereotypical lesbian way. Uh-huh. She just looked like your friendly Protestant grandma, you know?
Okay.
And but I spoke with them. They gave me information, and I didn't go right away to that church, but after a few weeks and trying some other churches, I went to this church. And
just a sec, then, where you had decided you needed to look outside of Mormon church, you decided not to participate anymore.
Right. Yeah, I was in that space between August, I guess it was July. It was the 23rd of July that Tanya and I had our first kiss. Kind of remember that with the 24th of July being the next day. And so from that point until October, I was going through a phase of trying to find a spiritual home, because that was so important for me. And that was really the reason I had stayed in the LDS church for all of my life, is because I was such a spiritual being and I needed a place for that. And so I really couldn't feel that I could completely go on without some connection to God somehow. And so I was going through kind of a searching phase of seeing what I could find.
Yeah, would this be an okay time to ask you then, what was your perspective about the truthfulness of Mormonism, or how did this play into any other witness you might have received when you were younger?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that did go through a lot of evolution in that year. And, you know, in a way, I had always both had a testimony and both doubted all of my life. And I'm realizing now how very common that is. And just like I had shut down my sexuality, I'd also shut down my doubts and just brought forth my faith as much as I could. And I had a life full of tremendous spiritual experiences, had felt close to God all of my life, and did so in church and did so in the temple. And so there was a point when I was a teenager and was going through these questions of sexuality. It was the same time that I had an anti-Mormon friend who gave me literature, and I read it and it really troubled me. But I chose to stay in the church and focused on the spiritual experiences I had had. And around that same time, I prayed about the Book of Mormon and was reading in Helaman and was overcome with the Spirit and said, okay, I'm feeling the Spirit, so that must mean that this book is true, and that must mean that the church is true, and that must mean that all doubt must go away. Mm-hmm. And so I did a lot of equating there and then continued to strive for anything I could that would cause me to have spiritual experience and then remain in the church, because I really, really wanted to do that. I mean, you know, my family meant everything to me. The church was my life. So that was my goal. And then as I started throughout my life, I always was really intrigued by people who were from different countries or different cultures or different religions and wanted to know more about them. But of course, every time I did, it brought up that doubt in me. And I remember once listening to NPR. I can't even remember the name of the anchor or person who was speaking, but he was Jewish. And he was talking about how someone anti-Semitic had left a message on his answering machine. And it was just really hateful. And he said, you know, those of you who never doubt or who don't have empathy, I guess that's what he said, those of you who don't have empathy have one advantage over us who do, because you never question your own beliefs.
Yeah.
And that just stung, because I thought, I am closing down empathy. I am closing down understanding of other people just so I can hold on to this belief and not doubt. And how can that be right? And
that's a tough criticism of Mormons, not of all Mormons, but of a lot of Mormons, I have to say that this was the hardest experience I had kind of facing my family after I stopped believing, was that I couldn't see that they had any capacity to appreciate my experience or to understand it. And I don't think that's universal. I think there are lots of Mormons who can kind of look at a Hindu and just see the beauty in it and see how that person could really, really buy into that. But it wasn't what I was surrounded with. So I see how that must have been striking when you stopped and thought about it.
Yeah, yeah, because I did have to face that truth in myself that I was pushing down. And I guess really the more I traveled, the more I left Utah and spent time with the most beautiful, wonderful, spiritual people who were divinely guided, the more I realized we don't have a monopoly on truth here. And that was really difficult for me because, you know, that opened up a whole new can of worms. But really, that was happening at the same time that I was interacting with Tanya, and that was allowing me to maybe have hope that God would not condemn me, but that maybe God was bigger than my understanding had ever been, and that maybe I could have the love of my life and have a close relationship with God, still be a spiritual being, and be in a committed relationship with someone I really loved. And so that was kind of where that journey went. And that same summer that I came out to Tanya, I had been reading a lot, studying a lot of other religions, other spiritual paths. And so that was happening simultaneously. I came out to her first and then continued. Then I tried to go to church for a couple of weeks after that and just was sick inside. It was excruciating, really. And, you know, that was the point where I emailed the bishop. I'd been released from my calling as young women president earlier that summer. And, you know, I was still having spiritual experience with all of this. I knew 2 hours before I was released that I was going to be released. I had this feeling of peace and relief wash over me. And I knew, as I had always known, I'd always been spiritual in these moments, and it was no different in this moment when I was being released from my last major calling ever, was, oh, you are now going to be released. And sure enough, within 2 hours, the bishop called and released me. And so anyway, at this point, I emailed him, told him that he might need another substitute for the primary class that I had been teaching and that I would be doing a lot of traveling. And I just left it at that for then until I sent him my letter of resignation a few months later.
But the outcome of this was, I mean, let me see if I'm interpreting where you're at correctly. Just by asking, how did you interpret then your prior experiences that made you feel like you had a testimony? Was it because you were framing them in the way you were taught to frame them, that any spiritual experience is evidence that the church is true or
yes.
proof that the church is true? But when you stopped, said, well, it's not proof that the church is true. It is a spiritual place. It is good. But it's not really an answer to that question. It's an answer to a different question. I don't know. How would you frame that?
Bingo. I think that was a perfect interpretation, what you just said. And I think what I had learned to do was to feel the Spirit and immediately say, this means that this is true. You know, and I think so often we do feel the Spirit, and it is the right path for us if we follow what we feel. And I have no doubt that earlier in my life, that was the right path for me. And I hadn't met the love of my life. I hadn't met my soul companion. And this was perfect scaffolding, to use a term that Sam used in our teleconference. It was perfect scaffolding for me. I have no regrets. I'm grateful for that experience. But then that same kind of spiritual experience, I guess I could use the Mormon term, testified to me that it was time to go on and time to expand spiritually. So yeah, I would say that I overinterpreted that as fitting into what I had been taught, which was, this is the one true church. This is the only place you will find the fullness of truth. And so any spiritual experience I would have was immediately categorized into, this is evidence that the church is true.
Okay. And that makes sense, because that was my experience of how Mormonism is framed and how testimonies are framed. And I think that, you know, I don't want to speak to what other people believe, but I can see how when someone arrives to where you arrived, how it would be not that hard. Well, it certainly was hard, but at least possible to reframe it and to keep those perspectives that you had and keep those spiritual experiences, but to put them in a bigger, as pieces in a bigger puzzle than where you were putting them.
Oh, absolutely. And by so doing, I was able to recognize and accept and appreciate spiritual experience that any human being in any religion, or someone not even in a religion, can have an experience, that they can be guided divinely, that they are taken care of. And someone can have just as powerful a spiritual experience as I've had in the temple countless times, going to their synagogue or going to a mosque or walking in the woods. You know, we do not hold a monopoly on spiritual experience. And that's been probably the biggest change for me theologically, I would say.
Right. But let me just ask another theoretical question. I'm not sure if this is the best time to have this sort of discussion, but do you think that, supposing that you didn't have to confront this issue, do you think you could have taken this new, meaning being in a same-sex relationship, do you think you could have taken this newfound perspective of spirituality and still made it fit for you within Mormonism?
Well, a lot of people do. I don't. That's hard for me, because I didn't choose to do that. And I think...
You didn't for a very excellent reason, but I'm just trying to say, in a theoretical world, in this hypothetical world where that dilemma didn't exist.
Yeah, I don't know, because I feel like I was hiding multiple parts of myself in that sexuality piece, in that doubt piece, trying to make it fit so that I could stay an active member of the church and everything that that meant. I guess I would say if I weren't gay, I probably would have stayed in the church and maybe expanded spirituality so that I could continue going to the temple, continue be a fully functioning part of my family, go to weddings, etc., but then read Buddhist literature on the side and, you know, practice other spiritual paths as well. I think that would have been the way I would have gone if I hadn't been gay. But being gay, I don't think I could stay in the church and be in a committed relationship. And that works for some people. I mean, you know, they're fine even going and not being able to take the sacrament. We have dear friends who do that. And I'm happy for them that that works for them. But I was feeling incomplete and feeling like I was not treated as a first-class citizen. in that space, and I wanted more than that. And I kind of felt like it was important for me to be an advocate for other youth, other gay people, to be able to say, I've expanded beyond this. I have a new life, and it's working for me. Not to force anyone else to do what I have done. I would never ask anyone to do anything except what was right for them. But just to be able to say, hey, I'm completely free now to practice spirituality in the way that I want to. Honestly, I'm still figuring out what that means, and probably will be for the rest of my life, because now I realize, I think Tanya mentioned this, there are infinite possibilities, and that's something I had never been able to consider before. So if I might go back to the UCC church.
Yeah.
Karen, can I jump in here for a minute?
Oh, sure, Tanya.
Yeah, please, Tanya.
There is, just based on some of our conversations that we have had, Karen, I think that there are two other issues that are strong for you. And if you disagree, please say so. But I think that that there is also dissonance over issues of women in the priesthood, and or women praying or having leadership positions or being healers. And Karen is a healing presence, and she's a very healing person, and I can attest to that, but she's never given an opportunity to have that recognized in the LDS framework. And Karen is a very strong leader, and of course that's been clear because she's been given, been called to the highest callings that were available to her at the time that she was in the church. But Karen really is a strong leader and a spiritual leader. And so for her, I don't feel that there's a way for her to grow into that leadership in a deeper way where she can bring all of the spiritual gifts that she's been given out. And those have been closeted as well. Would you agree, Karen? I mean,
yeah, you're right. I was, not that it's a bad thing to get into that, but I was thinking about that and choosing not to get into that discussion, but it's fine. It's fine.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Tanya, because this is just another issue that for you and for a lot of people ends up being a deal breaker as far as how much they participate.
Yeah, and I think about my gay friends who stay in the church. A lot of them are men, and so they, you know, and I guess that's not necessarily fair because they don't necessarily have the priesthood either. If they are in a committed relationship, but I think they are treated differently. And in my academic job as a professor, I feel treated like an equal in a way that maybe I wouldn't have been in the LDS church. And at the same time, that's not to say that women aren't completely appreciated in other ways, but I didn't fit the mold of a wife and mother, and never really ever wanted to. And so when I would get on that bandwagon and say, oh, our greatest purpose is to be a wife and mother, and we don't need the priesthood because we have the power of creation, you know, I would be saying these things. They were scripts that I would say. Yet at the same time, it was an empty message that I was giving because I felt empty. I felt like I couldn't be complete. And, you know, this Tanya's talking about being a healing presence and recognizing that there are many alternative healers who practice Reiki and other energy work who can heal through the laying on of hands, you know, and I've become aware of this. And expanding beyond one paradigm, beyond one worldview. There are many healers in this world who walk among us and who don't have the one priesthood that we're taught about, or you know, the two priesthoods, I guess I could say. And this is another thing for me as well.
I'm really glad Tanya brought that up too, because I think that if you feel called to let your light shine, you know, It wasn't just letting your light shine. It was allowing you to develop yourself in a realm that wasn't open to you. Not just to let your light shine, but also to let your light grow. So I can see then why in that, given that it was one more reason why it had to happen outside of activity in the church.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, but then getting back then to your UCC experience, why don't you come back to that?
Yeah. From the first week I went, I was in heaven. I mean, it was, I walked in this place, was filled with the Spirit. And again, this is something I was taught was not possible, but I walked in this place and there was music and Spirit and joy and a female pastor, speaking of feminist issues, a female pastor who had a sense of humor and who was artistic, and it was just such an incredible experience, and I cried through the entire service. And then went back the next week and cried through the entire service. And here I was in this healing space week after week after week. And I, after that, tried to go to a couple of other churches. And I said, oh, you can't just find this new church this quickly. That's silly. You've got to look elsewhere and see what else is out there. And nothing was like this. And Tanya's pastor from the Mennonite church that she went to, I met with her a couple of times, and she was such a great help to me. And I told her about this UCC church, and she said, so you're going here September through May. That's a period of 9 months. And we just looked at each other and we laughed because we realized this was my womb, as it were.
Yeah.
I had this womb as I was being rebirthed, if you will. And the time I spent, two pastors there, both women, and the associate pastor is an advocate for gay and lesbian, transgender, queer, etc., individuals. And she just is the most spiritual woman who can read your soul. Whenever I see her, it doesn't matter, I won't even say hello to her. And she'll walk up and she'll say, this is going on in your life. Are you doing this? Are you taking care of this? And it's like she can read right through me.
Wow.
And these two women held me and this congregation, actually. I sang in the choir every week. And they held me in a space of healing. And they just kind of, it became a joke that, oh, there's Karen and she's crying again. But they loved me in spite of that or because of that, I don't know. It didn't matter because I was there and they knew I was in this healing space. And that, I'm so grateful for those people. Now, I'm bearing my testimony. I love it. I'm so grateful for those people and the support that they were. And you know what? Miracles kept happening. Little things like paying my tithing to this new church and having financial miracles, they still happen. And I would receive guidance in ways that I always had before. I was asked to speak in church once and had the words in the scriptures just come to me, just as they always had before. And here I was, openly gay, going to a different church, and still opening my heart to spiritual things, and they were still happening, and perhaps even more so because I was more open to them than I had ever been.
Right.
So I don't know what else you want to add about that year, Tanya.
Yeah. Well, I've kind of neglected Tanya a little bit because it's partly a phenomenon of not knowing the interesting questions to ask her even though our experience was similar, I guess part of it also is that you might have been this – might not have been such a pivotal year for you in the same way it was for Karen.
Well, it was in different ways that aren't important to this conversation, but it was a year I think we were meant to be apart. I think that was a good divine protection for both of us. So we both had a year to grow and to become and prepare ourselves for being a couple. And I think that I watched from afar, watched Karen come out, watched her have this wonderful support of lots of new people coming into her life or people that were in her life that she was able to embrace more fully. And I just saw her kind of blossom and have this, she was surrounded by such lovely people that were helping yeah. her and supporting her and affirming her for all of who she is. And, you know, we would talk, of course, we would Skype almost every night and almost every day she would have a story of another person who had provided some sort of loving support for her. And I really felt she was surrounded by angels and people full of life and spirit that really helped her in that year. And it was quite beautiful, even though it was hard for me being so far, knowing that she was struggling, going through so many ginormous changes in her life. But she was provided with all of the gifts that she needed to make that transition in so many ways. And so I think that's all I have to add really about that year.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, then let's hear about your amazing wedding in Cape Cod. It must have been amazing.
It was, because Tanya planned the whole thing.
Okay.
Well,
we're at Cape Cod.
South Chatham. Yeah.
Okay.
We were on a limited budget. I was in grad school full time. Karen was working as a visiting professor, and so we wanted to have a great party, and we wanted to have a wonderful spiritual experience. So, on my kind of small budget, I had some wonderful creative ideas come up that made things work. But we rented a house right on the beach. And I knew a woman who was a celebrant. She was also a dance movement therapist, and I was taking an authentic movement class. And that's where I met her, but found out also that she did ceremonies and rituals. And celebrants specialize, of course, in people that are coming together from either different traditions or people who are needing rituals outside of religious frameworks and that sort of thing. And so in the fall, actually, right after Karen and I were, you know, Karen was out and we, you know, had proposed to one another, we decided to have a relationship blessing. And so when Karen had flown back to Boston, and I think it was October, right, Karen?
Yeah, when we had the blessing, yeah.
Yeah, it was early October. We had her bless our relationship, so we hired her to craft a ceremony and to officiate at a ceremony, and we went out into the woods, and it was a beautiful ceremony just for the two of us to have to kind of, because we knew that the year was going to be a challenge for us. And then after that experience being so positive, it was very easy for us to think, oh, yes, we need to have her back to do our wedding. And
wait, I have to add something about the relationship blessing.
Okay.
After this was over, Tanya and I went to the Boston Symphony and saw them perform Mahler Resurrection Symphony. And Tanya cried through the whole thing. It was so cute.
It's one of my favorite pieces.
Well, it sounds like you were really mindfully there. You were in the present, and that's what allows you to... I mean, that's what spirituality is about, is being able to experience things to their fullest. And so if you just went through an intense spiritual experience and then went to participate in a beautiful musical event, it makes sense that you would have been open to the richness of that.
Yes.
To me.
Yes, yes, absolutely. But yeah, we planned the wedding. I had some wonderful friends that I was in the grad program that I was in that helped. We did a lot of things that were homemade and very artistic, because I was in an expressive arts therapy program. So I was surrounded by artists and musicians and dancers and theater people. And so it was a very creative, fun sort of community collaborative endeavor. But we got everyone out to the Cape, and our friend Michael provided a lot of the music for us, and he's a phenomenal musician. And it was a very unique ceremony. It was totally, you know, crafted to suit our background, and we intentionally chose for it to be interfaith or interspiritual, because, you know, we had friends there that were Jewish and Muslim and Christian and LDS, because some of Karen's family came, and so from lots of different traditions, and perhaps some that were, I think there was someone who was Wiccan there as well. So we had lots of people from different traditions coming, and we wanted something that would be open to all people, but not offend anyone, right? Uh-huh. So something that was very universal. And so our celebrant was... that's what she specialized in. So she put together something that was quite lovely in terms of the ceremony, and we were involved in every aspect of its planning as well. She, you know, did premarital counseling with us as part of that process, which was also very helpful. And so, yeah, Karen's folks flew out along with Karen's sister and husband. So we had family there. My parents were there. And, of course, a lot of our friends in Boston and in on the East Coast were there. Our friend Patricia from Mexico even flew in. It was lovely, but still a kind of small, intimate gathering. And it was lovely. Karen, what would you add to what I've explained?
I don't know. I'm not thinking of the ceremony right now, but of my family, and maybe we can go back to that after we talk about that. You brought up my sister, mm-hmm. and that reminded me of my siblings and coming out to my siblings, and so we can talk about that after the wedding. Mm-hmm. But regarding the wedding and spiritual experience, we're talking about that a lot tonight. What a powerful experience that was. Tanya's friends in the Expressive Arts Therapy program held a space for us that I can't even describe, but it was so full of love, that space. Mm-hmm. And I had still been waffling back and forth between fear and joy, and, you know, still do sometimes, because it's all a transition of, you know, grieving over what is lost, but at the same time being happier than I've ever been, you know. Yeah. And that was a unique moment in that year where I could completely feel the joy and just be completely open to that. And I think because those people helped create that space, it was just such a beautiful experience. And we had a gluten-free wedding cake, and it was so yummy. And Tanya's amazing food. Here she was for her own wedding, making all of this food for the dinner, and it was
just... your own catering, huh?
We were on a budget, and fortunately our wedding wasn't so large that was impossible. It was doable, but. Yeah.
And you also managed, since we knew we'd have family coming in a couple of days before the ceremony, she had a to-do list and let people just pick something off the list that they might want to do to help prepare. And so we had people going to the fish market to get scallops and, you know.
Yeah, little adventures were planned that were supposed to be fun, like they're going out to the Cape to do things, but they're also going to the bakery and picking up some bread and... You know,
yeah.
So we timed it out so that it would be like that, but that everyone would feel a part too, which was a beautiful thing actually, because it gave the family a chance to interact. They were all staying at this house as well. So, you know, my parents and Karen's family were interacting. We were chipping in and doing things together, and it gave us a sense of time or of space of time where we could build a new family. And I think that was really important. We had made up a puzzle out of our engagement photo, and we had it, you know, in the room mainly for our dads, I think. So there would be some sort of something to do when in those down moments where that might have been awkward. And it was a wonderful place for people to come together and just sit and be social. And I think that it really did work. And so we did things like that to try to bring the families together. So I think the homemade elements and some of those things that we had planned for activities really were good and set up that also set up a good space for the ceremony that happened later.
Yeah. And just remind me, so Tanya, you were a legal resident of Massachusetts at the time, and that allowed you to get legally married, because I understand that's a requirement in Massachusetts, or at least was.
Yes, we were. It was wonderful. So yes, we went and got our little certificate, and yes, it's official.
Okay.
And hopefully in a few days, it'll be official where we live now. But
yeah, if DOMA happens, or...
Yes.
Well...
Or goes away.
Being recognized federally, mm-hmm. or whatever. I'm quite trying to make sense of what that's all going to mean. But
right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that sounds like a beautiful thing. And that was the start of your life together. And how long has it been?
Well, that's so hard to answer because, you know, the wedding is one thing, but I feel like we've been together forever. But
yes.
Yeah.
That was 2011, so just over 2 years that we've been legally married.
Yeah, so there's different dates, and in a same-sex partnership that has a history that way precedes the marriage, it does make more sense sometimes to talk about when you met or when you first declared it was a relationship. But it's also beautiful to think about your wedding anniversary, too.
Being married. Yeah, we celebrate, we have quarterly anniversaries for different things. When we met, when we fell in love, you know, so plenty to celebrate.
Yes.
Well, Diego and I have those too, and that just helps us forget all of them. So you guys, we managed to celebrate zero anniversaries. But that goes right along with not celebrating our birthdays or Christmas. That's sort of our modus operandi. So.
Well, if every day is a celebration, then you don't have to look forward to certain ones.
That's right.
There you go. Well, I like the idea of the ritual and the recognition. We just, for some reason, aren't made up for doing that. And maybe we'll be inspired by your example. Well, then I'd like to hear about your life together.
It's the best. It is so beautiful.
It is. It really is lovely to the last 2 years in particular, after we were back together, after being apart, really have been reassuring and comforting. And it's been nice to be able to spend all of our energy on being a couple instead of navigating some of the challenges to being a couple that we were navigating before. It's so nice to have that energy all focused and to be able to travel together and to get to know each other more deeply and be able to see each other completely as well. And I think that was really difficult to do before when we weren't being completely honest with one another and we were still dealing with so many things. But I think
she's being really nice there when she says we weren't being completely honest with one another. That means when Karen wasn't being honest with me.
Well, okay, but you know, after we were...
Well, it wasn't that you were dishonest, it's that you weren't...
You couldn't be yet.
...really aware.
Yeah, I wasn't honest with myself. Yeah.
Right,
so possibly be fully disclosing what you don't understand.
Right. Yeah, I mean, denial is something that is a protection that our system, our psyche does to protect us, you know, so denial goes away the minute we're strong enough to handle whatever the situation is. But if we're not strong enough to handle a strain on the psyche, then we do have denial. And that's the same as like our body having shock, right? When we're physically injured, you know, if we were in an accident, our body might go into shock to preserve itself. And I don't blame Karen for being into denial about that. I certainly was in denial part of my life as well. And I'm very sensitive to that. But it is true that it is very hard to love someone when they're in denial. And when Karen came out of that and transitioned through her coming out 9 months or year, whatever it was, and then the wedding and then our blessing that we had back in Illinois. And it was like, after that time, we moved, Karen took a new position. We moved to a different town and we had a chance to just start to settle a bit and to really become comfortable in a way that we really hadn't. And I think that's something that's continued over those 2 years. Certainly Karen is still grieving and we're certainly still growing in our relationship and going through challenges to our spiritual understandings. Each of us going on our own spiritual path and coming in and traveling together and talking about these things. But both of us have our own personal work, our own personal journeys. But it's nice to have our focus be on our own personal spiritual journeys and on our relationship rather than on these other things that were really a distraction from that.
Barriers, yeah. So it is kind of like a clean slate and a broadening of your horizons. So you both finished up your education then? I mean, it sounds like shortly after your marriage, you also kind of met a new sort of career stability or not?
Well, Karen took a position and her, you know, it's, well, I'll let her talk about that, but I'm still actually a grad student. I did this crazy thing where I was actually doing two programs at the same time. And as we mentioned, I think earlier, Karen and I met at the in the doctoral program at University of Illinois. And then, of course, I went off to Boston because I was in grad school at a different university. So I kind of put the pause on my PhD. I took 2 more years of coursework in a different program, and now I'm actually finishing my dissertation this year because I'm integrating the content of those two disciplines. So, yeah, Karen's had to put up with me being a student all of this time, and she's been very gracious about it.
I mean, anytime anyone does dissertations, it's so esoteric that hardly anyone's even going to know what you're talking about if you tell us. But why don't you tell us anyway, just a little bit, what the general idea of your focus is between these two programs.
Well, I've been a music educator up to when I started the PhD program, but my research area took me, I was looking at health and well-being in music making and looking at challenges to that, like performance anxiety and things like that. So I discovered expressive arts therapy, and I started looking at, which is a integrated arts therapy. So it incorporates music and drama and dance and art and poetry and nature therapies all together in an integrated form.
And when you say therapy, as not psychotherapy per se, but as a therapy for illness or mental illness.
Yeah, it's applied
or to illness.
Right. And I'm not, I didn't get clinical credentials in that, because I'm really looking at integrating those principles of therapy and knowing the self or self-actualization. I'm looking at those aspects in the learning process. And I guess the gist of my dissertation is I'm kind of looking at where I see my niche is kind of looking at education often is about learning content and not learning about yourself. And I think that it should be both. So,
okay.
You know, I'm drawing upon Rogerian and Jungian principles and things like that, and I'm trying to integrate them more clearly in educational settings so that students can not just learn about trees, but they can learn about their relationship with trees and their history with trees and what are trees' personal significance. You know, that's just an example. But that's holistic learning, and I think that... knowing about yourself and your own personal development is a really important part of learning. So that's kind of what my dissertation is about in an arts setting.
Yeah, and where does one go once they have a dissertation like that?
well,
this is a question your parents are likely to ask.
They are asking this question. My dad asks almost every time we see them. I'm thinking actually about starting a non-for-profit organization, an education organization. So I may do some college teaching as well. I don't see myself doing a tenure-track position like Karen is doing, but I think I could apply what I'm doing in multiple areas in the community, in an online format, and in different places. So we'll see. We'll see where I'm guided to go with it.
Okay. Well, and often the best things, these kind of education really prepares you for something, and sometimes you don't even realize what it was it's preparing you for until mm-hmm. it sort of presents itself. So it kind of might have some exciting possibilities for you that you will discover.
Yes, I feel that. I feel that.
Let's be trying to be sage there. Did I succeed? Anyway, well, so Karen, then yours is more specific to music education, then.
Yeah, music education, psychology, studying student self-beliefs and how they change over time and contextual influences on why those changes in our self-beliefs might happen.
Okay, so, and now that you're finished, you are on a tenure track, which means you're a university professor, basically, or...
Yes.
Becoming a university professor, okay. And so you've been at that the past couple of years, and has it been as fun for you as teaching the kids? I mean, I guess college students are still kids when you're when you're our age, but
they are. It's a much more. I don't want to say I'm still working tremendous hours, but it's much calmer. I have time to stop and think while I'm working. And so the lifestyle for me is really good for my health. You know, teaching high school orchestra was the best job I will ever have. There's no question. It was so fulfilling in 1,000 ways, but really it was wearing me out. And especially when I was spending so much energy not being true to myself, you know, and working all the time, so I would be running for myself. But it really was delightful, but I am so happy to be doing what I'm doing right now. And I feel like now I'm teaching future teachers, have a potential for greater impact, and I can study and do research and really delve into some serious questions. And so I love what I'm doing now. But yeah, I miss those days a lot, and I look back at them with just the greatest memories ever. I still keep in touch with many, many of my students, and I think I always will. And I feel like a mother to many of them and a grandmother to their children or their students, and yeah. just wonderful memories.
Well, it sounds like a great opportunity for you to, you know, if I think society should just incorporate a major career change at around age 40-something. You know?
I think you're right.
Because we need it. We need to do something with a different energy when we're younger than when we're older. But anyway, I kind of was able to do that. It sounds like you guys both are able to do that.
Yeah.
So I'm glad. It sounds like you have a lot of exciting things to look forward to that are also in sync with where you are in life.
Right. We do some research together, which is really fun. Not all couples can work together, but we love the topics and the questions that are involved in the research. And we make a good complement because we approach research in different ways. So it's, we do work
together.
You're
literate in the same language, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tanya basically has all the brilliant ideas, and I kind of put them down on paper and organize, you know, how we might, you know, the systematic plan for how we'll do it. But she's definitely the wise one of the two of us with some really groundbreaking thoughts and ideas.
Well, I think we have different wisdoms, but to give you some credit, too. But
you need a visionary, and you also need someone who can put the vision into a practical plan, and they're both absolutely necessary.
Yes.
So it does sound like a great team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another thing that we're teaming up on as well is that this was actually Karen's brilliant idea, but we are interviewing people right now. We're interviewing long-term gay lesbian couples, and we're actually putting a book together. Karen, would you like to talk a little bit more about your brainchild?
Yeah, you're calling it my brainchild, but it was actually yours.
What?
First. Yeah. Yeah, and it happened. I remember it was when we were visiting a friend of mine in Utah and went to Deseret Book because my friend wanted to buy a book there. And so here we are, Tanya and me and this friend in Deseret Book. And Tanya's like, oh, here we are. And she's looking
good
around.
Good luck finding a book I want there. Or
I was having a little trouble relating, yes, I admit.
And she found herself in the family section and saw all of these books on how to have a happy marriage. And she said something like, why don't we have any books for gay couples on how to have a happy partnership? And so that kind of, you know, percolated in my heart for a while. And one morning I woke up and just started writing the chapter outline for this book. And then Tanya came back and said, you know, this is kind of the way we work, just go back and forth with each other. And she said, no one wants to hear a book full of advice from two people who've been married for 2 years. We need to interview couples who've been together a long time and learn from them. And, you know, then we decided, then it came back into my court and I said, well, let's compile this and just have chapters with different themes telling different stories of these individuals. So we're working on that. We're doing the interviews right now, and we will be presenting some preliminary ideas and findings from this at the Affirmation Conference in September. And
well, then we're gonna see each other there.
Yay! Yeah. Yeah, we're really excited about that. We have some fun themes. And I think we've interviewed two couples so far, and each interview could be its own book. These mm-hmm. stories are so beautiful, and we'll be finishing up more this summer, but it's just, there are so many inspiring stories. And another reason we thought of this book was because when I was at the UCC church, all of a sudden I realized that all these people in the congregation, maybe I'd see two women just sitting together and I wouldn't think about it, but all of a sudden I'd find out that they'd been together for 30 years or 40 years. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is not something I learned in Relief Society. You know, this just was not a possibility that people would be committed monogamous, the gay people would be committed monogamous and spiritual. And so because of that, we actually, after our wedding, came back to Illinois and had a blessing ceremony at the UCC church for those who couldn't make it out to the Cape. And at that time, we asked some of these couples to speak and give us advice. It was so awesome to, you know, have a couple who'd been together for 10 years stand up and give us wonderful advice, and then have a couple stand up, been together for 36 years and give us advice, and then one that we'd been together for 42. You know, and just this idea that, you know, is this possible? Of course it is. You know,
That was such an amazing experience, because I know that based on the large number of people that were there, I'm going to guess that probably 3/4 of the people in the room had never, ever conceived of the idea of a long-term committed couple. I mean, we had a lot of friends there that just had never met anyone like that. And several people even commented on that they had no idea. And yeah. So, you know, that's a book. We're hoping that the book really does help to share these stories, not only for people that are considering long-term committed relationships, but for their families, so that their families, if they've never heard of such a thing happening, that those families can read these stories and see that, oh, wow, this is possible, that this has happened, and it's just not something that's been, that these relationships have been protected. Some of the people have been together 30, 40, 50 years. When they were first in their early formative years of their relationships, they were completely closeted. And yeah. Some of them are still having trouble coming out of the closet because they've been closeted all of their lives.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
And so, you know, that's we're still, I think, with the people that have been in the longer term relationships, still to this day are still very protective of them, because they've had to be most of their relationships. So I think it's really important to get some of those stories out so that we can so that all of us have role models for healthy relationships.
Okay, I'll really look forward to seeing that emerge and to hearing your presentation in September. And it does sound like a really wonderful gift that you're making. So keep it up. How about if we just go back a little bit to your spiritual journey? I know, once again, you've described it as being very personal. But is it possible for you to say that your spiritual sort of stances or blend of Christianity, Buddhism, and this and that, is there sort of words you can put to it that might sort of be understandable to someone not directly related, or maybe not even that fluent in the language?
Which one are you asking? Both of us?
Both of you, yeah.
Do you want to go first, Karen?
I can, although you probably have an easier time articulating this. I am still floating in the mystery right now. I've just recently allowed myself the space to say, you know what, I don't know, and that's okay. And also to be able to say, I can't, I guess also to be able to allow myself to feel spiritual without punishing myself for it. And I don't know if that makes any sense whatsoever, but there's this built-in part of me from my upbringing that to feel the spirit outside of Mormonism was sinful in a way. And I don't know if that makes sense, but to have a spiritual experience is kind of, you know, I might do that and then might punish myself afterwards, you know, I mean, not literally, but in my head, like, what's wrong with you? You've left the church, your family's going to be upset with you, you're hurting people in your family because you are finding joy outside of the church. And, you know, and so there's this push and pull that still happens, I think, for me.
And there's so much unconscious So you can't even tuck yourself out of the unconscious elements of that going on, you know.
Oh, I'm starting to be able to. I think that's the big moment for me now, right. Just in the last year even.
And when a consigned kind of recognize it's there, it becomes more possible.
Right, exactly. To be able to kind of have this voice outside of myself that says, now look at this moment. You know, why are you saying this to yourself? And to be able to think anew and just be able to be in a moment of joy and not have that guilt associated with it that I've been trained to feel in certain moments. But to be able to just completely let go and open up to the spirituality that is already there. Tanya said yesterday we were on a walk and something about being light and full of sunshine. And I said, I hope I can be that. And she said, you already are. It's just, you know, the number of clouds that you are allowing around you. You know, the light is already there. And if, you know, a little bit of Buddhist thought there, but it's already existent. It's just, if you'll allow yourself to see it. And so that's kind of where I am right now. And
is it fair to say that you've turned away from trying to be so concerned about what is true and what is false and what is right and what is wrong?
But absolutely.
You've turned it into what is a spiritual experience that is sort of separate from this other people that, this other elements that people tie into religion.
Right, yeah, and I would say that I've, in a way, also given up on the idea of trying to capture a spiritual experience in the way I used to. I mean, it used to be currency, religious currency, to have a spiritual experience, right? And if you could cry in front of a congregation of people, somehow that was a demonstration of worthiness. I won't speak for anybody else, but I know for me, it was always, you know, this importance. You were worthy. You were living righteously. You were someone amazing if you were having a spiritual experience. And I've kind of let go of that so that I can just be real. And
it's too bad that it impacted you that way, because it is beautiful to experience something in a group, you know. Mm-hmm. But if it's distorted by having status associated with it.
Right. And I think I can still have that in a group, but I've opened up my definition of it, that it doesn't have to be in one particular group, but it could happen with my college students, which it does sometimes when they are singing, you know, in music education, when they're teaching a song to the class and the class is singing and there's unity there and connection. And that's a spiritual experience. And I can sit there and feel that well up inside of me and not say, oh, this is my opportunity to convert someone. It's not that anymore. You know, I don't have to frame it within any limited boundary. I can just say, this is a beautiful moment where we are sharing connection, and not have to label it as anything particular or make it fit into a certain frame of mind, but just let it be as it is.
Yeah.
So I guess that's kind of where I am, is enjoying the mystery and just enjoying the journey and exploring anything that I feel guided to open up or read or study. And that could be anything from Buddhism to music educators to religion to the woods, whatever it is, watching birds in the morning and just studying the absolute miracle of life.
You're nurturing the experiences.
Yeah.
So that they're conducive to bringing that, what you're calling spirituality, into the moment.
Yeah.
Okay, but Tanya, I'm going to ask you the same question then, and if there's a different perspective that is unique to how you see things.
I would consider myself an interspiritual person. I'm not divorcing myself from a Christian upbringing at all. In some ways, I still feel like I am Christian. However, I don't often label myself that, because I feel that that creates an othering situation. And I really resist all forms of othering, because I feel that they interfere with spiritual connection between people. And as much as I'm capable of getting rid of those false separations, I try to, and I'm on part of my spiritual path or my spiritual work right now is to try to see where I'm doing that in my own mind, in my own thinking, and try to get rid of that. Anything that might separate me from connecting authentically with people, with myself, with nature, with everything. And so being interspiritual is how I feel most comfortable, because that embraces all forms of religion, all forms of, you know, experiencing the divine. So I really like Ken Wilber's Three Faces of the Divine. And he talks about how in some religious traditions, there is a divine within. And in some religious traditions, like Christianity, there's an I Thou, a holy one, so the Heavenly Father or God in heaven, our Father in heaven, those sorts of images, that's the holy other. And then there's, of course, like pantheistic understandings or the third person perspective, where that the divine is experienced in the creation. So I have always had a really strong sense of the divine in the creation. I grew up in a rural area, and I was outside a lot as a child, and I always woke up to the birds singing, and my sandbox is right near a giant oak tree, and the trees were my friends. Yeah. And so for me, I've always had this really, animals have always been important to me, and I've had a really deep connection with the divine that way. And I could never make sense of that in my Christian upbringing, because that wasn't really considered God. And to me, it was so much more powerful than my most powerful experiences in a religious Christian context. And so I think a lot for me, when I was in my early 20s and 30s, when I kind of rejected the religion of Christianity, I found most of my connection in nature. But then and later in my early or my mid-30s, when I was kind of going through a midlife crisis, I had to go back to that Christian framework again and heal things and kind of put my pieces back together, because, you know, as someone in my mid-30s, I had a different perspective, a different understanding of those same concepts as I did when I was in my 20s, and I had some catching up to do. So I did attend a church for a while, and that was a very healing experience. Then I went off to Boston, and I started experiencing a much more diverse culture. I was interacting with incredibly spiritual people of different faiths, and I was a part of an arts collaborative where the expressive arts therapists and others in the community would get together, and we would share through art making and music making our traditions with one another. And it was a very amazing experience for me. It opened my mind considerably. And since that time, and at the same time, I was exposed to Ken Wilber's ideas. And since that time, I've really identified myself as interspiritual, because I've found so much beauty in other traditions as well as Christianity. And I feel that even though I'm certain that I still interpret many of the other world's religions through a Christian framework, I can't really separate myself completely from the scaffolding of my youth. I still feel like there's so much beauty there, and there's so much that I can learn from other people's perspective of looking at the divine. So, you know, pantheism and some of the Native American traditions really have an earth-centered spirituality that I find very beautiful and I resonate with very strongly. And of course, you know, the Christian tradition has the holy other, the Trinity in this case, or, you know, but those are holy others. The Godhead or whatever you want to call, that there's that sort of outside of the relationship. But then there's also this inner relationship where the divine is within each of us. And so this perspective resonates with many of the Eastern traditions. Also the Unity Church, which is Christian religion as well. But the idea is that the divine, that we are all part of, we're all one. And all one is divine. And so each one of us is a channel for the divine into the world, as long as we're congruent with the divine or with life force or universal energy or whatever you want to call it. And so it's really through these three ways of experiencing the divine that we can really have wholeness and fullness. So for me, that is definitely true. I have a relationship with the holy other. I cultivate and try to clear myself of ego so that I can be a channel for the divine within myself to shine forward. And I certainly try to connect to nature and the universe and try to understand my right place in it and try to live peacefully in harmony with the natural world as well. And I think all three of those are equally important aspects of my current spiritual practice.
Okay. Let me just add one more complimentary question to that then. Have you guys are now in a community, you're going to be there a while if Karen's on tenure track. Have you found a spiritual community or some other alternative community that you're developing there? How's that going?
It is very different than it was in Illinois. It was so easy to find a church community that was open and accepting, open and affirming in Illinois where we were. We have not been able to find a place, a church that feels like home, that's open and affirming. We have attended the Unitarian Universalist Church quite a bit. There's a Unity Church about 15 minutes away, 20 minutes away from us. We've gone to that as well. And kind of for 1 year went back and forth between them a lot, but really have found that third form of God that Tanya's talking about, the God in nature, is really our home place right now. And just recently, we have started having interactions with our celebrant again, who's doing spiritual direction. And we are Skyping with her. And that is a tremendous spiritual experience. But we do miss that community that we had through UCC and that, of course, I had as a Latter-day Saint, Tanya had in the Church of the Brethren. We haven't found that home here, but we've tried to create that in every way we can with people that we connect with all over the world, and technology has allowed us to do that, to listen to a lot of teleconferences, to connect through Skype with close friends. So we're finding those connections, but not necessarily through the church down the street.
Yeah, it's unusual because I think in the past for us, we have always had a local community connection. But right now, we really do feel it's an interesting transition. And I wonder if it's about the time we're living in as much as anything, is that we are connecting in different ways than we did before. And I think, I don't know, it's sometimes very comforting to have to be able to connect with people in different places. And other times I do miss being able to serve with other people side by side in a situation as often as I did in another situation. But yet we're still doing service, like Karen and I are doing the teleconference series for affirmation. So we're doing things like that, and we're talking with Carolyn Pearson and Judy Finch and Sam Noble, and we're all in different places and able to interact in a really powerful and meaningful way and serving side by side, but we're not standing side by side. We're, you know, and like we're doing, you know, this interview and not sitting side by side. And so I feel like we're in this transition where, you know, the world is changing and so are we, and we're kind of adapting to it in that way. And we're trying to be open to that as much as we can.
Okay. Well, I agree. That is certainly an important experience for a lot of us now, is what we're getting in online communities. And that's certainly my connection to any Mormon at this point, because I don't have a single Mormon in my physical world here. It's all part of my virtual world, this connection with the LGBT Mormon issue. So I certainly get that. So, okay, well, let's think about our sort of closing comments. And I'd like to give you each a chance to just kind of tell me your closing thoughts and your whatever testimony you might want to say. But before we do that, I just want to make sure there's not another important element that we might have left out to your story or your journeys.
I did want to mention about my siblings, to go back to that and the coming out process with them. About a month after I came out to my parents, it was right after October General Conference, actually, where Boyd K. Packer gave that speech that is now famous or infamous. And I decided at that point that I was going to resign from the church. And before I did that, I wanted to come out to my brothers and sisters. And we have an extremely close family. And I'm the youngest of seven siblings. And having them be proud of me has always meant so very much. And I was similar to Sherry Dew, considered myself the favorite aunt to many nieces and nephews.
Yeah.
And so that was extremely critical for me. And I didn't quite know how to do that because they were all over the country. And so what I decided to do was to write one letter and send it out to them via email. And so I sent it so I could disseminate this news at the same moment to everyone. And so I called them first and said, this letter is coming. And read it, and I'll let you contact me whenever you want. The night before, the week before I had done that, a couple of things happened. First was I went to the pastor of the UCC church, told her I was going to come out to my siblings, and she blessed me at that point and said, I'm blessing you and envisioning this ball of love that is surrounding you, that love can enter into, but nothing harmful can. And I just had that vision in my mind. And she said to me, how about your nieces and nephews? Will they be okay with this? And I told her that for some reason, one niece and her husband came into my mind at that point. And I wasn't sure why those two did. But I said, I have a feeling that'll be okay, but I don't. Well, I walked out of this meeting with the pastor and had a phone message. And so I turned on my phone, and I have like 60, 70 nieces and nephews.
Wow.
But the two that I had thought of just 20, 30 minutes before had called me during that meeting. And they said, hey, I know you haven't heard from us for months, but you gave us this little, it's hard to explain, but I had given them this jar full of sayings that they could open up and read. And they said, we haven't read these in forever, but we thought we'd open up one tonight. And it said, call Aunt Karen and tell her how much you love her. So we thought we would do that tonight. And well, you know, it was one of those tender mercies, if you will, of, you know, everything's going to be okay. And then I had a neighbor who was a Reiki master and an extremely spiritual person of alternative, no, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say alternative, of interfaith.
Less traditional.
Yeah, yeah, an interfaith spiritual healer. And we were talking, it just so happened that when I pulled into the driveway, she pulled into the driveway at the same time. And so I said, okay, this can't be coincidence. And so I said, all right, I'm coming out to my siblings this week. Any advice? And she told me about the Hawaiian practice of Ho'oponopono, where you come to someone and you say to them, I'm sorry, please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. And she said, I want you to practice that spiritually and go through with each of your siblings and go through this spiritually with them and don't go on to the next step until you feel it's the time to do so. And the next morning I drove, I had an hour drive, and I took that entire hour to go through my seven siblings and to work through this forgiveness. And I hadn't come out to them at all, but I wanted, you know, in a good spiritual fashion to meet them spiritually before I came out to them. And when I finally did call them on the phone to tell them the letter would be coming, it was so funny because I said, I'm sending a letter. I love you and I want you to know that. Call me whenever you're ready. And they were just instantly, Karen, we don't know what you're going to say, or maybe they did, but they didn't say that. We just want you to know we love you, no matter what. And they were saying this even before the letter. Then the letter came, and one by one, Tanya was in Boston. I was doing this by myself. I pulled out my cello because that's all I knew what to do, and I just played my cello until the phone started ringing. And all but one sibling called that day and talked with me. And, you know, they were all over. They ran the gamut from, I've been waiting for 20 years for you to tell me this. Thank you for finally being open. You know, to one saying, I never thought about this as something that would affect my family. I need to read. I need to study. I need to learn. And to some who were like, well, I disagree, but I love you. You know, but that was the worst case scenario, was I disagree, but I love you still. And you and Tanya are always welcome in our home. So it was a tremendous experience to have these siblings call one by one. And of course, the one who didn't call, my parents called the sibling and said, she's heard from everyone but you. Are you going to call? And so, of course, you know, that was all fine, too. It was just, you know, this person was very busy and, you know, working through some things. But what a gift that was for me to have. I attribute so much of that to my parents and the way they taught us about love and family and how important that is. You know, Karen may be leaving the church at this moment, but we love in this family and we will love her. So, and that's continued. I feel so much support. Tanya fits in so wonderfully with the family. They've really taken her in as my spouse, and yeah, they don't agree with everything, but they love us, and they see that we are in love, and they see that we are good for each other, and they support us in that.
And so has that helped you to sort of overcome your internal sense of awkwardness that is sort of inevitable when you are there with your same-sex partner in this Mormon setting?
I think it's still the habit of self-loathing, the habit of self-abuse, if you will, is something that I've just learned over time, and I have to still convince myself that everything's okay. But I've found the best way to do that is just to communicate to my family in the moment and say, I'm feeling like people are judging me. And then they can turn around and say, get over yourself, we're fine. You know, or offer more love, or, you know, don't you dare not come to this activity because we want you there. And so just communicating with them exactly how I feel and being genuine and saying, gosh, I'm a little full of low self-esteem in this moment. And they're like, you know, it's okay. It's okay. But just
well, it's
being,
nice to even be that open about it.
Well, yeah, just being brave enough to communicate. And I have Tanya to thank for that, because in the moments when I'm not, she calls me on it. So.
And you do likewise. It's a mutual thing.
Well, and you have Tanya, your family is much closer geographically. I mean, it makes, do you have more chances to associate with your family and your parents living as close as you do to them?
Yeah, actually, the last 2 years we've lived pretty close, within an hour's drive, and it's been a wonderful chance for Karen and I to spend time with them, and they absolutely love Karen. In a way, you know, they know that Karen is good for me, and they can see that I finally have a really solid, healthy relationship, which is something I didn't have in my earlier life. And they're so relieved, I think,
yeah,
by that. And but Karen is so gracious and so good with them as well. I think they feel very comfortable just with her as a person. And I think they feel very happy to have another daughter and one who is so loving as her. And so it's been really good to spend time with them. I feel like our relationship has deepened in this time that we've had living closer to them. And, you know, there's still awkward family moments when we meet with extended family and things like that. But some of that's because of other differences besides just the fact that we're a gay couple. You know, different interests and different worldviews and things like that are coming into play there. But
political parties and stuff.
That too, yeah.
Complicated.
Yes.
Conversations anytime.
But, you know, I think that for the most part, people can see that my relationship with Karen is a good one, and that they can at least support that and see that my life is happier and stable and is functional in a way that, you know, I wasn't able to do in my earlier years. And so that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. Or
being open and honest and straightforward and feeling more confident in myself, too. It makes a big difference in all my relationships, but certainly the family relationships.
Okay. Well, that's very beautiful. You've got that nearby, so at least one family nearby.
Mm-hmm.
That adds to the community, because family is part of community. So, okay, well, I'd just like to see then if either of you have any final comments then before we tie it up, or as a way of tying it up.
Two things just came to mind for me, and one is when I came out to my family, one of my brothers said, he quoted Book of Mormon scripture and said, men are that they might have joy. And he said, have joy. You've suffered for so long. Have joy. And I think also of when I was in the very first coming out process, I called Carolyn Pearson on the phone, and she said, "What makes your heart sing? That is of God. Follow that. Does Tanya make your heart sing?" And I was like, "Well, of course." And she said, "Then that is of God. Follow that." And those are the moments of truth for me now. It's just listening to my heart and letting it sing. And it's so simple, but it's so freeing to let go of the what if, the worries, the doubt, the questions that I've been trained to believe, and just let myself feel the joy that is just waiting to come out and be.
Well, amen to that. And Tanya, do you have some final words?
Well, I think for me, I feel like I should say something that I wish I could have said to my younger self from this position in life. I wish I'd have known when I was first coming out, when I was first struggling with matters of faith and spirituality, when all of that was a giant, tangled up, jumbled mess. I wish my current self could have gone back and just given myself a hug and said, all of this is important. You're going to be okay. You're going to have a deeper, richer experience later. And everything is meaningful. Don't take things so personally and so seriously. This is all going to work out. That's just what I would have said to my earlier self if I could have done that. And I guess that's kind of my message to anyone who might be listening that is really struggling with some of the issues that we've talked about in this talk, is that every person, whether they're gay or not, has life challenges. And we picked this particular one. And I think it causes us to not only question, not having those questions about sexual orientation, but also it forces us to have questions about spirituality and ask deep and hard questions about spirituality. And this is a huge gift. This is a giant gift, because there are some people that can go through life and don't have anything force them to ask those deeper questions. And they can have a more surface experience, and they're happy in that, and that's wonderful for them. But to me, I wouldn't trade the struggle I've gone through because of how it's caused me to grow. And I'm in a happy place now where I can look back at it and go, wow, that was worth it. And so I guess I'd like to end with that thought.
Okay. Well, amen as well. Well, and that's actually a sort of advice I think about giving my younger self too. enjoy it. Enjoy the process. Enjoy the journey, because it will lead to something that will make sense. So I'd really like to thank both of you so much. I'm really excited to see your other projects emerge and to hear your other teleconferences if you've got more, and certainly to hear your presentation at the Affirmation Conference in September and to meet you personally at that time. So I'm super glad to hear that you'll both be there. So I will thank you both and quote what just Karen just said, and quote what Helaman, I suppose, have joy.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was donated by George Parkinson and Kelly Clark Parkinson. Just bear this
started from disguise. The tokens in his hands, I knew the Savior stood before mine eyes. He spake and my poor name he named of me. Thou hast not been ashamed. These deeds shall thy memorial be. Fear not, thou didst them unto me.